Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most of us know stress as a ubiquitous fat maker, sleep interrupter, and general source of generalized anxiety. At least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But could it also be a status symbol in a world of supermoms and overscheduled kids? Sometimes not having a moment to breathe is confirmation of how important we are. And for my first guest, this is a big problem. Professor Dana Becker is author of the new book, One Nation Under Stress, The Problem with Stress as an Idea. And she's here with us by phone to tell us why our conceptions of stress are hurting the country. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks very much for having me.
So I told her, listeners at the outset, don't stress me out. You know, be a good guest. Your book subtitle is The Trouble with Stress as an Idea. Mm-hmm. But as a college professor and an author with deadlines, you can't tell me you don't believe in stress, right? So what's the problem?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people ask me and sort of, are you saying there's no such thing as stress? You know, that's crazy. And it would be crazy if that's what I were saying. It isn't. I think what I'm saying, and what I talk about quite a bit in the book, is that the experience that we're now calling stress, and of course there, as you noted in your intro, you know, there are so many experiences now that fall under this rubric that we, you know, let me count the ways. Almost everything we talk about today in modern and postmodern life we think of as stressful. Mm-hmm. So we have ways, we've had ways throughout history of talking about our experience and talking about what our anxieties, where our anxieties bring us. And in this past, say, 40, 50 or more years, stress has become increasingly popular as a way to characterize our experience. So it is the way we talk about how outside events affect us inside. And one thing that I talk about in the book is how that hasn't always been the case. That, first of all, we didn't have such an idea many years ago. And then when the idea was first developed and research on stress first started to take place, we actually thought about stress quite differently. We thought about stress more as having to do with the circumstances and situations and conditions that were occurring in the outside world and their effects on us, certainly. And first research was, of course, on animals, but on our internal experience of health, and certainly later our psychological experience. But one of the arguments that I make in the book, one of the things I say, is that I think our focus has become so much more on the side of the what's happening inside us rather than the conditions outside us that are causing us to feel the way we do.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dana Becker. She's a social work professor at Bryn Mawr College and author of One Nation Under Stress. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Finish that thought, Dana.
So as it's, you know, now that we're in the age of, we could call ourselves in a kind of therapeutic age, where in the middle class, we think about our emotions a lot, and we certainly, in this age of high medical technology, we think about our insides a lot more than we used to. Mm-hmm. As I say in the book, I think we're practically on speaking terms with our immune system. We've become preoccupied in the middle class with what's going on inside us, both mentally and physically. And I think the idea of stress really contributes to that preoccupation. And one thing that I really argue, I guess, throughout the book is that it really robs our attention from those social and political conditions that really are causing problems for us in the first place. So I want to make clear that I'm not saying we don't have problems. I'm not saying that we can't experience physical and mental stress, as we would call it today, but that our preoccupation, and I think the media has supported this, popular press has supported this idea that we should be looking inward And we should find the answers to the problem of stress inside ourselves. We should do things that help us to feel better.
In other words, deal with it, because the outside world isn't going to change, so just cope with it, whether it's a Xanax or an Ativan or yoga or whatever it might be.
So it's eat more kale, do more. I mean, this is a very it's a middle class kind of problem with middle class kinds of solutions. So it becomes sort of eat more kale, do more yoga, meditate a bit. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing to take care of ourselves. Of course, it's a good thing, but it becomes maybe one can see it in sharper relief when we start to talk about things. When we start to talk, for instance, about poverty as a stressful condition, and then we start to say rather silly things like, well, of course people are depressed because they're poor, so what we really ought to do is get them more therapy or give them more antidepressants, right? And we know these are not cures for poverty. We know that we have to have social and political change if we're going to do anything about poverty. But I think this is sometimes where the idea of stress takes us.
So it's like we're treating the symptom and not the disease.
I think you've got it, Ann, really.
Any listeners out there have a question or comment on this, agree, disagree, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also post something on our Facebook page. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I know we don't have a lot of time with Dana Becker, but I'd love to hear what some of you out there think. How did stress go from a symptom of something larger to a disease in its own right? Because it certainly is. I mean, okay, so I have high blood pressure, but I have high blood pressure maybe because of stress.
Right. Well, I think
I don't have high blood pressure, by the way, but go
ahead. I'm glad to hear that, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I think that what happened really maybe in the 80s or so, and certainly as we became more able to study what goes on inside people, there became an interest certainly in the functioning of the immune system. And we began to see connections even before that, certainly, but increasingly between what happens outside the person and what happens inside. And even though I think that the field of what we call psychoneuroimmunology, I can hardly pronounce it myself, but this field started to blossom, and we don't have tremendous concrete answers to exactly how the stress process eventuates in disease, but we do know that there are certain things that can cause people to become more vulnerable to disease. But somehow the idea that all stress is necessarily bad or problematic really hasn't been with us for very long. I mean, even the big popularizer of stress, Hans Seeley, who worked in the 50s, 60s, and even into the early 70s, used to talk a lot about good stress. And today it doesn't seem that there's much stress that people talk about that's good. So what we begin to see is that although certainly stress can contribute to disease process, there's much more made of this than there necessarily should be. That in fact, in a healthy person, we could be exposed to a fair amount of stress without ever becoming ill. But I think we've developed the idea that any measure of stress is necessarily bad for us in body and mind. And one of the points that I make in the book that your listeners might be particularly interested in is this idea that as women, as middle-class women began to go into the workplace in fairly large numbers, we started talking a lot about women's stress and what women needed to do to combat it. And I think that's been a very strong message even up to the present day. So the idea that if you're having trouble juggling things, right, if you're working outside the home, you're taking care of children, you're doing all these things, you're necessarily going to be stressed out, and that it's your job to really to de-stress yourself, that we haven't really gone very far in the way of changing workplace policies, in the way of extending daycare or developing universal daycare, that our political and workplace policies are lagging far behind where dual career, dual job families really are. So it's interesting that as a society, we've become so taken up with this idea of how stressed women are. And I think it serves a kind of purpose to suggest to women that really they have to fix the stress problem themselves.
Yeah, it's more of an individual issue.
That's right. That's right. We just need, we've always been in this country pretty committed to the idea that we can work on just about anything. And if we just fix ourselves, we'll be okay. And that I think that message is more prevalent today than it ever has been. And it means that a lot of the solutions to the anxieties we face, we look to ourselves to fix or to cure, and it puts actually, you know, some people might say it puts more stress on the person.
So how do you distinguish, or how would one distinguish between those kinds of stresses, the external stresses mm-hmm. that they're feeling on the inside, and other kinds of stress that is something that isn't about the outside, but mm-hmm. is coming mm-hmm. from inside and mm-hmm. needs to be, I mean, how do you start to separate it all from what the doctors say and, you know, the kind of stress that the pioneer women went through versus the kind of stress we went through? They didn't
right.
have,
they
you know.
They didn't talk about stress.
No, they just talked about how we're going to eat tonight.
That's right, how we're going to do it. I think that, I don't think we can ever, we can't really separate. And we try to do this in the West, don't we? We do have a big separation between mind and body, right? Mm-hmm. And between the inside and outside. And I don't think we can really do that in the case of stress. I think we do have to say that when things are not going well on the outside, there are going to be some changes on the inside, not necessarily all for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
But we really want to know, we want to know that if we're under absolutely chronic conditions of stress, it is going to, it could affect our health, and we want to be careful about that. At the same time, it doesn't mean that we also can't think about where this chronic stress is coming from. For instance, if we need two incomes, and most families do, to sustain themselves, right?
Three or four sometimes.
And we don't have mm-hmm. enough help, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly if they're part-time jobs, mm-hmm. which many women have to hold, mm-hmm. multiple part-time jobs. Then we say, well, is the problem really the stress of juggling? Well, I do need to take care of myself. That's an important and good thing. At the same time, do I really need to think about what conditions I'm operating under? My boss isn't allowing me to take a day off when my child is sick, right? Or I'm not really sharing the housework 50-50 with my mate, or workplace policies are terrible and I'm not able ever to work from home, or maybe I should be agitating with other people collectively for universal daycare because I can't afford daycare for my children, and it's problematic for me to have to work and spend half my income on daycare. So again, I think we need to do both. Certainly, I'm not suggesting we stop taking care of ourselves or we stop taking care of our health, but I think we have to stop persistently seeing the problem as only our problem to solve. So I think we can really do both and think about both. And my idea in writing the book was really to take sort of stress out of the system of things that we don't even think about critically, you know, that we don't even imagine we could think about differently, and sort of get people saying, whoa, why am I saying every 2 minutes I'm stressed out? You know, everything from a hangnail to the war on terror is causing me to be stressed out.
Right.
And I want to think about, first of all, the hierarchy of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to think about the conditions I'm laboring under. And I'm the conditions that I'm living in that are creating something around me that's really troublesome. Of course, in America, we've always had ideas about the fact that the pace of life in this country is ever punishing and so on. We've had those ideas ever mm-hmm. since industrialization. And we take a certain amount, as you suggested in your intro, we take a certain amount of pride, too, in the fact that we're the busiest and the most high-tech and so on. At the same time, it worries us. And I think that historically has also been true.
Well, Dana Becker, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. Lots to think about.
Thank you very much, Anne. I appreciate it.
Dana Becker, she's a social work professor at Bryn Mawr College. She's also the author of a new book. It's called One Nation Under Stress, The Trouble with Stress as an Idea. Coming up, we'll continue with Wellness Wednesday, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. Celebrate 30 years of In the Know on WOSU-TV with a tournament featuring local celebrities and corporate teams. Thursday evening, watch teams AEP, Nationwide Insurance, Valgren Mortine, and WOSU to prove they're as smart as high schoolers. Catch the In the Know Celebrity Challenge Thursday evening at 5 on WOSU-TV. Sunshine for today, a high near 81. Clear skies tonight, a low of 57. Support comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. The Council for Older Adults of Delaware County can help reduce stress of caring for older relatives by providing tools and support needed to keep loved ones living safely and independently at home. More information is available by calling 740-363-6677 or online at growingolder.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An estimated 8 million Americans suffer from some form of eating disorder, and patients often die from complications such as heart problems and suicide. We often look at eating disorders as if they're something that we can control. We can just decide to stop the problem. But that's not necessarily the case. Some new research out of the University of Toronto offers a promising treatment of anorexia, sort of a pacemaker for the brain. And here to tell us more about the study is Dr. Blake Woodside. He's director of the Eating Disorders Program at Toronto General Hospital and one of the study's lead researchers. Welcome to the show, Dr. Woodside.
Thanks very much, Ann.
So first of all, let's kind of set the scene here as far as what we mean by an eating disorder and whether or not it is something that you can say, you know what, I'm going to start eating today, or I'm going to stop purging tomorrow, or that kind of a thing.
So we're talking today about one of the more serious forms of eating disorder, which is the illness anorexia nervosa. This is an extremely serious medical condition that has one of the highest rates of mortality of all psychiatric conditions, around 15%, maybe as high as 20%. And in addition to the 15 or 20% who die from the illness, an additional 15 or 20% will develop an illness that is chronic and treatment resistant. So they'll go on being sick for many, many decades. And these people are sick. They're not bad. They're not making a lifestyle choice. They're totally, controlled by their illness like somebody's controlled by cancer or by heart disease or anything else. It's a medical sickness. It's not a choice. And it can be lethal in many cases. So that's what we're talking about.
And the acknowledgement or the discovery of that, that it's not a choice, that it is an illness, a physical, it's manifestation of something absolutely physical, really has led to different kinds of research in it.
Well, I mean, the research into treatment for anorexia nervosa, if I was going to write a book on new treatments in anorexia nervosa since 1950, it would be an extremely slender book with about 10 pages in it, because there has been very little new in the treatment of anorexia for a very long time. Our standard treatments help about half or 6 out of 10 of people with the illness and will help them to eventually recover, but there's that big group of 30 or 40% who either die or remain chronically ill. And these are people who generally fall ill when they're young, in their teens or in their 20s, and are sick for 20 or 30 years before they die. So they're an enormous, there's enormous suffering involved for the person who is ill and for their families, a huge burden on the healthcare system, enormous lost productivity, and these people don't work and they can't contribute to society. So, it's all negative. There's nothing good about it at all, and it's a substantial problem.
Tell us about the study. Who participated in it in the first place?
So the study that we've been doing for the last year and a half is a highly experimental trial. It's called a phase one trial, looking at a specific procedure called deep brain stimulation in individuals with chronic severe treatment-resistant anorexia nervosa, so people who really tried everything and nothing has worked. The procedure is relatively routine. It's a neurosurgical procedure that's used extensively for illnesses like Parkinson's disease and also for depression, and involves two very small holes being drilled in the skull and electrodes being very precisely placed in a very complicated way in a specific part of the brain. And then a very small electrical current is delivered to that part of the brain via a pacemaker-like device that is born under the skin. And the intent is that this is permanent, that people will continue to have this stimulation applied on an ongoing basis.
What's wrong with that part of the brain that requires this stimulation?
So we have the ability now to look at brain function. So most of the time, if you think about taking a picture of the brain, you're thinking about structure. So you're thinking about a CT scan or an MRI scan, which shows you where things are in the brain. But we have new techniques that actually allow us to look at how the brain is functioning, what areas of the brain are underfunctioning, what areas of the brain are overfunctioning. The specific area of the brain that is being targeted in this procedure, which is called the subgenual cingulate, is known to underfunction in anorexia nervosa. And that part of the brain is heavily involved in how your mood and your anxiety are regulated, like to have normal responses to things. So this electrical current is trying to make that part of the brain more active and have it become more normal in terms of its activity.
So it doesn't have anything to do with your appetite or anything like that?
No. So what we're seeing with this, and we have had 12 people have this procedure at this point, we're hoping to do 10 more cases in the next year, is that there are very limited immediate effects on the core symptoms of anorexia nervosa. So sometimes people get some decrease in their binging and purging if they have binging and purging, or decrease in their activity. But what we see very routinely at 3 or 4 weeks is that people start to feel better. So that they have less depression, less anxiety. If they have obsessions and compulsions, they start to be reduced. If they happen to have post-traumatic stress disorder, that tends to be less of a problem. But it doesn't have any direct effect on the eating disorder, which is curious. But then what happens is that people come back 4 or 5 months later and say, you know, and by the way, it's very difficult to improve any of those symptoms of people with bad anorexia with drugs or any other treatment. Like, it's impossible to improve depressive symptoms normally in people who are very underweight.
Unlike someone else who could just take a pill. Okay.
Correct. So 4 or 5 months later, what we're seeing is that many of the patients, of the first six, five of the first six patients, have come back and said, you know, I think I want to try treatment again. I feel so much better. Like, I just feel better. I think I could make better use of treatment. And for those first five who came back to treatment, none of them had ever completed treatment before, and they all had uneventful admissions and completed treatment. So we're putting them into remission from their anorexia. That doesn't guarantee that they'll stay well, and I'll comment on that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But what this is like is if we've had people, you know, six people with cancer, like bad cancer, that had 10 courses of chemotherapy, and the chemotherapy had never worked, and we do something, and all of a sudden the chemotherapy starts to work, and we get them into remission. That doesn't guarantee they'll stay in remission, but that's a necessary first step to recovery, to be able to get yourself into remission. And these are striking findings. These are people who've had between them maybe 50 admissions, 50 intensive treatments, and never had a good response. And all of a sudden they are immediately responding to the treatment. Of the first five who had, actually there's been six come to treatment, one is well at about 9 months after 20 years duration of illness. One is doing very well. She's not fully recovered at this point, but she's doing quite well at about 4 months. One immediately relapsed, and three more just finished treatment about a month ago. So we're watching them with great care. But it's very, very striking to watch people who we've had in treatment over and over and over again and always bail out of treatment and have terribly difficult treatments and never able to come in and basically just have an uneventful treatment experience because they feel so much better.
Mm-hmm.
So they respond more. Things bother them less. Like, things bother them like they bother a normal person. They can tolerate their stress more easily. They work with the team more easily. It's very, very striking.
What do we see in the brain that led you to this?
So there's brain imaging studies of how, very limited studies about how the brain functions in anorexia nervosa, and there's some areas of the brain that are known to underfunction. And at a year, we have data on, I think, 8 patients right now, at a year, we're looking at brain function again. And the areas that we would expect to improve if the stimulation was going to work are improving, so that people's brain function looks more like it should do. And there are actually changes in brain structure. So in many of these patients, there are actually increases in the size of specific areas of the brain that we would expect to increase in size if the stimulation was having a beneficial effect.
My guest is Dr. Blake Woodside. He's director of the Program for Eating Disorders at Toronto General Hospital and psychiatric professor at the University of Toronto. We're talking about a study that he is of which he is the lead researcher, that is a promising treatment for anorexia nervosa. It's kind of a pacemaker for the brain. It's been described that way. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Woodside, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. The results are promising, but it's a very small sample.
Absolutely. This is very early days, and these are very, very preliminary results. They're encouraging enough to make us want to continue the investigation and continue the trial and try and do 10 or 20 additional cases and have a good long look at what's actually happening. And we think, you know, what is most likely happening, if we're correct, is that we're altering the natural history of the illness and putting people on a different trajectory that can eventually lead them to a recovery. But we don't know that for sure yet. That's our best guess right now. It's probably going to take us another 2 or 3 years to be able to say with confidence that that's what's happening.
You mean that you're changing what's happening and how the brain functions?
Absolutely. So people people who come into this trial, this is not a frontline treatment for anorexia nervosa. This is kind of last ditch desperation treatment. These people are on a trajectory that is likely to lead to a premature death. Like, that's where they're headed. That's the direction they're going. So what we may be doing is altering that trajectory from likely having a premature death to being able to have the chance of recovering.
And what do you make of those for whom this did not work?
So when I started my involvement in this trial, I worked very closely with Andres Lozano, who's the head of neurosurgery here at University Health Network and is the other lead investigator in this study. You know, I said I would be happy if we got a quarter to a third good responses, because these are people who, you know, for whom nothing had worked and were very likely to die from their condition. I would like everybody to get a wonderful response. We did not expect 100% response rate at all. And we don't really know why it's working for some people and not for others. It seems to be possible, if you work really hard at it, to diet away the effects. So most of the people who are in the study were at a very low weight, but they were stable, and their caloric intake was stable. I had one or two people who went on a major weight loss campaign fairly early on after they had the device implanted, and some initial positive effects disappeared because they were losing weight so rapidly. So that, you know, that's something we're looking at with care. But we've only got a dozen cases at this point, so it's really, we don't have enough data yet to tell why some people respond and why some people don't.
That's interesting, but sometimes you can learn so much from the ones that don't respond.
Well, I mean, we learn in whatever way that we can, and of course, we don't want anyone not to respond.
Right.
But if there's data to be gathered, we'll gather it.
This is a stigmatized medical condition. How difficult has it been to find people to participate at that stage in their in the history of their disease?
So I think that's an excellent question. So we recruited our first 12 cases in 14 months. By comparison, it took 2 years to recruit the first 6 cases for a trial that's going on in Alzheimer's disease, and nearly 2 years to recruit the first 6 cases for a depression trial. We've got an OCD trial that's running 3 years and has recruited 3 subjects. So we're recruiting at the most rapid rate of any of these trials of deep brain stimulation and psychiatric illness. And we've been in a pause for a couple of months waiting for ethics approval to extend our trial, and we have 6 additional people who are lined up waiting for this procedure. And I think the message there is that these are not happy campers. You know, these are people who, despite, you know, they look like they have no interest in getting better, but they're willing to try something that's highly experimental and invasive if it offers them any hope of a better life. And I think that speaks to where most people with anorexia are. They're desperately unhappy with their condition. Some people will say they aren't, and that's fine, but most people are desperately unhappy. And for many people, conventional treatment will work, and for other people, it just simply doesn't work, and they'll try almost anything to try and feel better.
What are the ethical questions in research like this?
Well, the first one is whether these people are competent to make the decision to participate in the trial. Mm-hmm. So we have a number of safeguards built in to ensure that the people are, in fact, competent to give consent to participate in the trial. Patients have to be seen by two different psychiatrists who are experts in the field to identify that, you know, basically all other avenues have been exhausted for them. And there's a long period of preparation for the surgery where people have lots of opportunities to change their mind and say no. So that's the primary thing. It is neurosurgery, but we've done, for example, over 1,000 cases of the exact same procedure for Parkinson's mm-hmm. disease here at Toronto General Hospital or University Health Network. So it's the procedure itself is relatively routine. It's the application that is brand new. So it's brand new to use it in anorexia.
In this study, you're looking at something that would change, would affect someone's mood, affect someone's depression or level of depression, that sort of thing. Are there other parts of the brain in people that could be contributing to this kind of eating disorder?
Sure. And there's multiple areas of the brain that are not functioning normally in anorexia nervosa.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is that those areas of the brain all interconnect. They all have connections in terms of neurons. And we see changes in other areas of the brain as well that would be compatible with what we would expect to see if people were going to get benefit from this procedure by and large. Again, we have only very limited data on the brain functioning stuff, but that's what we're seeing in a preliminary way.
A pretty exciting time, though, in brain research right now.
Well, this is a totally novel approach to treating, a disease which was first reported in the English language literature in 1693. This is an ancient illness. It's been around for over 300 years in the English language literature. And this is totally new. And it's acceptable to a segment of the population that is very, very seriously and offers them some hope. That things might change.
Well, Dr. Woodside, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Blake Woodside, Director of the Program for Eating Disorders at Toronto General Hospital and a psychiatric professor at the University of Toronto. We've been talking about research on treating anorexia nervosa with brain surgery by planting stimulus in the brain, kind of like a pacemaker for the brain. If you have any more questions about that, we'll have links to the study on our website at WOSU.org. And stay with us. We have more on Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, evidence that some criminals may have biochemical or neurological irregularities that make them more prone to commit violent crime. We talk with criminologist and psychiatrist Adrian Raine, the first researcher to do brain imaging studies of murderers. His new book is called The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. Sunshine today and a high of 81 degrees. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 57. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher on Thursday for a conversation about the African adaptation of Julius Caesar being staged at OSU right now. Then take a walk down memory lane with Ohio Public Radio's Bill Cohen, who is retiring after 30 years on the job. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon. Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga is located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com. And support comes from the Wellington School, where fearless learning is celebrated in preschool through grade 12. The Wellington School will host an information session for prospective parents on Wednesday, May 8th at 9 a.m. More at wellington.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Cardiovascular disease is not only a leading killer of Americans, it is also costing us big bucks. In 2010 alone, heart disease and stroke accounted for almost $450 billion in healthcare expenditures and lost productivity. These enormous losses spurred the Department of Health and Human Services to launch the Million Hearts campaign in late 2011, an initiative with a mission to prevent a million strokes and heart attacks by the year 2017, in just 6 years. Ohio State has sponsored several Million Hearts health screenings, and here to tell us why she's excited about it is the university's wellness officer, Dr. Bernadette Melnick. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Happy to be here.
So a major component of this project is adhering to the ABCs. That's an acronym. What does it stand for?
Correct. I think what the Department of Health and Human Services did so perfectly was give people a simple way to remember some very key points about how to take care of their cardiovascular health. So the ABC stands for A, aspirin control or aspirin therapy for high-risk individuals, B, for blood pressure control, C, for cholesterol management, S, for smoking cessation, and we here at Ohio State added a second S, and that is for stress reduction, because we know when we are highly stressed, the body produces stress hormones that have negative effects on the cardiovascular system.
What kinds of screenings has OSU sponsored?
We are doing what's called Million Hearts screenings, and we go out into all the units across campus. We've been in the community to do screenings as well, and those screenings typically consist of blood pressure screens. We also do body mass index because, again, the more factors that you have to put yourself at high risk for stroke, such as obesity, high blood pressure, unhealthy lipids, as well as smoking and stress, the compounding rate for poor health outcomes. So we screen for all of that, and then we educate folks or get them to a provider who could help them manage these particular risk factors better.
I just wanted to stop and talk about the second S that Ohio State asked, just because it's something we were talking about earlier in the program, and stress. And the title of the book we were talking about was One Nation Under Stress by Dana Becker, and her point is, yeah, we have stress, but all we're doing is treating the symptoms of stress and not dealing with maybe the poor employment situation or the circumstances of our society that create it. And that's, you know, almost overwhelming. How do you weigh in on that? And what do you do for people where stress is a leading problem for them?
Well, I think we have to remember, it's like when we talked about behavior change. You can work with individuals on specific stress reduction strategies, but you also have to create environments as well as cultures that make it easier for people to reduce their stress levels. Any of those in isolation aren't going to tackle and get to the root of the problem in helping people to manage their stress better.
My guest is Bernadette Melnick. She is the Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate Vice President for Health Promotion, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University. I don't know how she does it. I say that every time she's on the show. We are talking about the Million Hearts campaign. It's started in late 2011. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Melnick, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So how does the Million Hearts campaign or project plan to gauge its success? How do you measure prevention.
The goal, exactly. The target outcome goal for Million Hearts is to prevent 1 million heart attacks and strokes over 5 years. And that is feasible in terms of data collection because states across the country, we know, for instance, in Ohio, how many people report high blood pressure, how many people are overweight or obese, how many people smoke, how many heart attacks we have and strokes. So that's the ultimate goal, prevention of 1 million heart attacks and strokes over 5 years.
But if people don't have them, I mean, you're just looking at the numbers and want to lower them?
Yes.
Okay. So the smoking cessation piece of this is critical. It's a huge thing. And OSU's president, Gordon Gee, has announced his wish to make the university smoke-free by August 1st. It was really interesting, the percentage of people who smoke on campus versus the overall population. I think it was 40% versus the overall population's around 20, or was it 60-20 or something like that?
No, we actually at the university, in terms of faculty and staff who smoke, we only see about 5% smokers. So,
but overall?
Overall, that is how many we see. However, in our state, the last report of the numbers of smokers in Ohio, we're almost at 25%. And it's much higher in our areas of Appalachia.
And so how is this going to, how is the work at OSU extrapolate out, or, you know, how does it spread out to Appalachia?
Exactly. OSU is very community engaged across the entire state. In fact, we had a grant just funded by one of the faculty in our college, Kate Golick, who is going to lead taking Million Hearts education and screening and working with OSU Extension, because they're in all 88 counties of Ohio, to screen people and to educate them about the ABCs. So again, the university is very, very actively engaged in the community and across the state in promoting good health and wellness outcomes.
What about the smoking cessation plan on campus? Do you think it's going to work, or could it cause extra stress for people?
You know, you bring up an excellent point, and leaders at Ohio State have talked about this at length. So we do believe have the plan to go tobacco free. And at the same time, we will provide many support services, smoking cessation services, tobacco stop services, and stress management services at the same time. Because we do want to do this with gentle encouragement and the provision, again, of great support services for people to be able to quit these unhealthy habits.
Are the avenues to address these issues largely kind of middle class? I mean, exercise, smoking cessation, a lot of those things, these things are things that people have access to when they have a decent job, when they live in a community where there's the resources for all these kinds of things. What about people who are poor, who are struggling at two or three jobs, and cigarettes are best friend of the day?
Right. Well, one thing I want to emphasize, let's take physical activity. I don't know why, but there is this real perception that you have to belong to a gym in order to be actively engaged in physical activity. And that couldn't be any more further from the truth. You can engage in effective movement and activity right in your own home. I know safety in many neighborhoods is a real concern for people in terms of getting out, walking, and so on. But again, we emphasize activity that can be done right at home, right at your workstation. I mean, there are multiple ways to engage in activity.
Once again, my guest is Bernadette Melnick, Dean of the College of Nursing and Vice President for Health Promotion and Chief Wellness Officer at OSU. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the Million Hearts campaign and OSU's involvement in it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you have a question about heart health, you can also go to our website, you can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Do you have a sense of what the greatest motivator for heart health is for people? Do we know more about how people associate this? Because a lot of people with blood pressure don't even feel it. They don't know they have high blood pressure. They don't know a lot of their symptoms exist.
That's right.
It's hard for them to react to it.
That's right. I think you're bringing up a very important point, and that is many people with high blood pressure do not realize they have it, which is why it's critical that they do engage in routine screenings. I don't know if you saw the last report from the Centers for Disease Control that was just released in April. The number of Americans with high blood pressure has actually increased. Almost 30% of Americans now have high blood pressure, and only about half of them have it under good control.
You said they've actually increased, meaning this goes against what should be happening. Don't we have all this medicine now and all of these?
We do. But
this
again,
knowledge.
Again, it's not only raising awareness, but it's effective management. And again, not everybody with high blood pressure is controlled, which is why knowing your numbers, asking about your numbers. When you go to your primary care provider's office, you'll have a blood pressure taken, but sometimes people don't tell you your numbers, believe it or not.
Well, they always just tell me mine's fine, and I never really understand what the numbers mean.
Yeah.
Can you just go over that?
I sure
can. For the heck of it right now?
Sure. So there are two numbers that are given with blood pressure readings. The top is your systolic number,
which means
that's the amount of force that is exerted on your blood vessels when your heart contracts. Then you have the diastolic blood pressure with the bottom number, which is the resistance of blood against your blood vessels when your heart is relaxed. The most common normal reading that we tell people about blood pressure is 120 over 80. We begin to worry about folks who are 140 over 90 and higher. So again, critical to know your numbers, critical to tune into your symptoms. And Anne, you asked about what motivates people.
Uh-huh.
To do something about any health condition that they have. So much of the time, it's when a crisis happens or people's emotions are raised that they make a decision to do something to engage in healthier behaviors.
We just have a few minutes left with Bernadette Melnick. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You had a big event here last week. You're the first, by the way, chief wellness officer at any university in the country.
Correct.
But last week, a bunch of people from universities across the country got together to talk about that.
Right. We launched the inaugural National Summit on Building Healthy Academic Communities. Academia, sadly, is behind the corporate world overall in promoting health and wellness. That surprises a lot of people, but corporations have been hiring chief wellness officers well into this past decade. What we're trying to do is create a movement, a collaboration among universities and colleges around the country to improve population health through ramping up their wellness activities across campus for faculty, staff, and students.
So it's not just for the big shots at the university then. This is for everybody who works here, everybody who attends here?
Correct. It's for everybody who lives and works in an academic setting.
What at Ohio State, since you've been on the job now about 2 years almost?
Almost in
September.
Can you believe it? Hard to believe. It's been a great journey so far.
How are you measuring your success on that score?
Right. We have multiple outcome measures that we look at. For instance, we ask faculty and staff to complete a personalized health assessment every year. They report out on a lot of their traits, their characteristics, their blood pressure, their lipid levels, and so on. And so we're able to track such leading health indices like body mass index, lipid levels, risk for depression, anxiety, those sorts of things. And what we want to see is a trending down on the unhealthy health outcomes.
So I think I've been doing this for about 3 years now, 3 or 4 years. What do we know? Does it help?
We do. We actually, I presented data at the summit last week that we are beginning to see a trend in the positive direction on some of these key outcomes. I think to totally turn the culture as well as the environment here at the university, it's going to take another 3 to 5 years. But we're very pleased that we have really implemented a lot of across-campus initiatives, and we're starting to see trends moving in the right direction.
You know, a reason why a lot of corporations and so forth have gotten into this so much earlier is because of costs. And I'm wondering if there's a sense about what it's costing the university or saving the university, I should say, in healthcare costs. Do we have a sense about that, or is that something farther down the road, too?
That's going to be something that we can continue to track and monitor as we continue to ramp up our wellness initiatives. Studies, though, have shown that for every dollar that's invested in prevention and wellness, there's a return on investment of $4 to $5. But I think it's critical. Yes, is that a reason that we are ramping up wellness initiatives here at Ohio State? Certainly. But the primary reason we are doing this is because we care about our people, and it's honestly, Anne, the right thing to do.
Well, Bernadette Melnick, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Glad to have done it.
Once again, Bernadette Melnick, you've heard her before on the show, Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate Vice President for Health Promotion, Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University, the only one of her kind in the country. Thanks to everybody for listening on Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks to the staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series.